From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we'll start this hour with the destructive power of Mother Nature. Floodwaters receding in some areas around Baton Rouge, Louisiana today. At least 11 people have died, and at least 40,000 homes have been damaged. And with relief efforts underway, the Red Cross is calling the flood the worst natural disaster to strike the United States since Hurricane Sandy.
Meanwhile, in the San Bernardino area of Southern California, the Blue Cut Fire flamed furiously overnight, stretching across 30,000 acres in just hours. It's destroyed homes, forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate, and it continues to spread, fanned by wind and temperatures peaking over 100 degrees. Here's San Bernardino County Fire Chief Mark Hartwig at a press conference today.
A lot of homes lost. There'll be a lot of families that come home to nothing. If there's a bright side, a silver lining, there are some homes that were saved.
NPR's Kurt Sigler is out at NPR West in Culver City. And Kirk, what made this fire so bad so fast?
Well, the number one thing you can point to that everybody's pointing to is the historic drought here in California and the climactic conditions out here. You're hearing from the fire chief there and others out on the ground saying this is unprecedented growth. They've never seen a fire spread this erratically and this quickly. And it has to do with, in part, the drought and the fact that some of these fuels, this brushland, the measurements being taken by fire managers who, as they try to map the severity and where the fire will go next, the measurements of the fuel moisture content, kind of a scientific term there, are so low, historically low. In some cases, the land is even being described as the brush is just dead. So you can imagine this is just some remarkable kindling for a wildfire like this to grow and spread. And it's, you know, also in an already dry area. It's the typical dry season in California to begin with. It's burning into the high desert. So this is going to be a very active situation for some time. And, you know, firefighters are never going to be able to just put something like this out, a wildfire going this fast, without the help of Mother Nature in some sense. So we're going to be tracking this, and a wildfire like this is going to be very active throughout the day and the days ahead.
Chilling words. Now, we know it caused two main roads, Highways 15 and 138, to be closed. Are people able to evacuate, to get out safely? Are there enough shelters?
Well, that's the big question. You know, Interstate 15, as you mentioned, is the or one of the primary east-west routes here in Southern California, linking Los Angeles with Las Vegas. When that shuts down, you can just imagine the logistical challenges this poses for people trying to get out of that area and for fire crews and other equipment trying to get in. There are a number of shelters being set up. There's also some that have been set up already, I should say, and many people are using them. There are also shelters for pets and large animals. There's a lot of people own horses in this area and other livestock. And just the sheer number of people being evacuated. You know, we've had some very, very large fires and very destructive fires, and we've been covering that, you know, throughout the West recently. But at least in my memory, I haven't seen, at least in recent history, the scope of an evacuation of a wildfire like this just this big. There are so many people in the area and so many people at risk, and I think it speaks to sort of the severity of the situation.
Right. Look, having lived in Southern California for many years, there's no way I'm going to assign blame here, but many people are asking, we know this is wildfire season, we know there's an historic drought. How do fires keep starting? In Northern California, a man has been arrested and charged with arson in the fires there, but is it, you know, carelessly thrown cigarettes? I mean, how does it happen?
Right. And we want to stress that in this fire that we're speaking of in San Bernardino, you know, the cause is still under investigation.
Right.
But we can infer that most of these blazes are human caused. In fact, the majority of wildfires in the West that ignite every summer and the very few that get out of hand are typically human caused. We didn't have any lightning in this area that would start something like this. But it is so dry that, of course, it can be careless human behavior like a cigarette butt, but it can wildfires like these also start after sparks on a highway. And I want to stress that I'm not saying that that's what this wildfire, we don't know the cause for this yet, but any number of things, a down power line, just given just how dry things are out on the land right now. You couple that with the fact that there are a lot of people living and working in these areas, and most of these fires are human-caused. And as you mentioned, up in Northern California earlier this week, a suspected arsonist was arrested, possibly in connection with the Clayton Fire, which is just one of several very large and fast-moving wildfires that are creating a lot of destruction in California. So yes, it is certainly wildfire season, and the public is aware of this, but you know, you just have a lot of situations going on in a very active situation where there are certainly going to be human-caused fires like this.
A reflection off a crystal. NPR reporter Kirk Sigler in Culver City. Thank you so much.
Glad to do it, Robin.
Well, in Thailand, police say they are making progress tracking down the people who carried out a series of bombings that killed four people last week. They're looking at the possible involvement of Muslim separatists in the south. Those attacks coming nearly a year to the day after a much larger bombing that killed 20 in the capital, Bangkok. Joining us now from Bangkok is the BBC's Jonathan Head. And Jonathan, let's start with that bombing from a year ago today, because unlike a lot of attacks that we've seen around the world in the last year, that one was not ISIS.
No, it was not. It was such a shock when it happened. You know, for years, and I've been here a very long time, we've talked about the possibility of terrorist attacks. You've got very hardcore Islamic groups in the rest of Southeast Asia. You've got a Muslim insurgency in the deep south of Thailand. Everyone wondered whether it would happen. There are so many potentially vulnerable targets because of the tourist industry. So when we did get this enormous explosion, we were really baffled as to who it could be. Really, within a couple of weeks, the authorities had picked up two ethnic Uyghurs, that's the Muslim minority from Western China, who they have charged with involvement in the bombs. And they've certainly got some evidence against one of them. And that does tie in because just a month before the bomb last year, the Thai authorities had expelled around 100 Uyghur asylum seekers. In the Uyghur part of China, there's resistance to China, a lot of repression, and many of them are fleeing and trying to get to other countries. And this group had sought sanctuary in Thailand, and to appease the Chinese government, the Thai military very controversially had sent them back. And we'd always wondered if the bomb was retribution for that. And catching these two men and talking to them, it seems as though that's the case, that these were Muslim Uyghur militants retaliating for the expulsion of their countrymen from Thailand. But the Thai government won't admit that because that would be a form of terrorism. They insist, their story is, it was just a people smuggling gang who were frustrated that the authorities were cracking down on their business. That makes no sense to any of us. It was a big, powerful bomb. You don't do that if your business has been interrupted. This clearly had a much stronger motive, but the Thai government isn't willing to talk about that.
And any connection between that attack from a year ago and the bombs that we just saw last week?
We may never find out. And that's what's frustrating in this country. These bombs, too, were a shock. They hit the royal city of Hua Hin. That's where the king's favorite residence is outside Bangkok. He's a very important figure here, the royal family is. It was on the queen's birthday, and it hit tourist areas of Hua Hin and hit several other towns. They were much smaller bombs. But immediately what we saw was what we saw last year. The military government rushing in, insisting it wasn't terrorism, ruling out groups who we thought might be connected. This one, this year, looks as though it is connected to those Muslim insurgents in the very deep south of Thailand who are fighting for autonomy. And they've never really strayed outside their own small provinces before. So that would be a new departure. But the government doesn't want to talk about that. Again, like last year, they've been very vague. They're issuing lots of contradictory statements. And nobody's really sure how serious they are about investigating them. So once again, a year on, we have bombs that have killed people, not as many, but very nasty bombs, and where the way the authorities are handling it gives no confidence they'll come to any conclusions.
You've mentioned the government a few times. This is a military government that ousted Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra 2 years ago. Now, there was just a new constitution approved. Give us a sense just of the politics right now in Thailand and how things are changing.
Well, the military, when they took over, argued they were there to restore peace and order to a country which had been wracked by political conflict. Initially, you know, everyone thought, as in past coups, they'll very quickly revert back to a civilian government. This military government isn't like that. They say they do not want a situation where there is political conflict again, and they've kept very tight control. They've repressed free speech. They've detained people who've resisted them. And the constitution referendum was held in those circumstances. There was no free debate. No one was allowed to discuss it. And this constitution, although it does restore some form of elected government, leaves the military and other unelected bodies very much in control. And hanging over all of this, of course, is the fact that the king of Thailand, King Bhumibol, who, of course, was born in the United States. He's actually an American citizen, apparently the only American king in the world. He's been on the throne for more than 70 years. He's very old and extremely frail. He's seen as the absolute focal point of this country, the sort of spiritual core of it. And, you know, he's on his last legs. And that's going to be a very traumatic and difficult moment for this country. And we all assume that in the minds of the military, they've got to keep control, they think, until they've got through this very difficult royal succession. So it's a buttoned up country where you can't really openly criticize the government and people are quite careful about what they say.
And the King of Thailand has been on the throne longer than Queen Elizabeth, correct?
He is the longest reigning monarch. Yeah. He took the throne in 1946. Thais don't ever remember any other king. So even if it weren't for the fact that he's immensely revered, and I'm bound by the very strict laws, so I can't talk about his successor, but we can say he's certainly nothing like as popular. So either way, it's going to be a very wrenching transition for Thais. They're not allowed to talk about it. They don't like thinking about it, but it is coming and it won't be long.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok, Thailand. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Maybe you've heard of James Altucher. He was a successful web designer, ran the hugely popular site StockPicker.com, and was a frequent stock analyst on CNBC. His hedge fund was so productive that he rented a helicopter to get to weekend poker games. When StockPicker got bought by TheStreet.com, Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics said it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But wait. Altucher confessed in a 2011 post that he used to hack into the emails of people who were threats to his businesses. That's not nice. And then it all unraveled. The hedge fund collapsed, so did his life. And now James Altucher spends time talking about trying not to have anything. He's written 16 books, including the best-selling self-help book, Choose Yourself. He hosts the weekly podcast, The James Altucher Show. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show. This is such a pleasure.
Well, and I got to tell you, I don't know where to start with you. You know, you've had this unbelievable roller coaster ride of a life. You're beloved by your readers, bestseller in your self-published book. But you even wrote a post about being hated. You know, it's called The Ultimate Cheat Sheet for Dealing with Haters. Who are you?
Well, you know, it's a funny question because it's sort of like people have a name, then they have a comma. It's like James Altucher, you know, stock picker or hedge fund manager. But I think it's okay to just not have anything after the comma. So I enjoy writing. I have invested in many companies that I hope will do well, and I've started several companies. Most have horribly failed, and some have done okay. And I enjoy lots of things.
You are called by others a self-help guru. You know, you've shared what you've learned. But, you know, we hear about the failures. Why should people listen to James Altucher?
Well, they absolutely should not. Like, I don't call myself a self-help guru. I specifically say, look, I've lost all my money. I've gone broke. I've gone bankrupt. I've been depressed and suicidal. I've been on the floor with no hope. And then this is what I did to come back so I could be productive again and be happy again and so on. It might not work for anybody else at all, but I enjoy describing what I did, maybe too much. And if other people want to try these ideas, that's fine.
Okay, well, let's look at some of the ideas, for instance, in Choose Yourself. I mean, and the point behind it is that we don't live the lives that our grandparents might have lived 50 years ago, where a company seeks you out, keeps you for 50 years, and gives you a watch. You can choose and must choose who you want to be.
Very true. We don't even live the lives we lived 5 years ago. You know, the economy is changing and we're changing. The average person stays at a job in the United States for about 4 or 5 years. Companies merge. The economy forces you to move. So either way.
You also point out that, for instance, somebody who may not feel that they're right for college could take that $200,000 that they might spend on college, and maybe they're an entrepreneur, they could invest it. Or you could learn basic web development. Go to codeacademy.com, learn the basic skills in 3 months, then sell them on freelancer.com, where there are millions of jobs.
Right. Or go help charities build schools in other countries, and your cost is maybe the plane fare to get to the country. There's many alternatives you can do to build a network, to build skills, become qualified for either a very good, meaningful, productive job, or to start a company. And now some people say, well, not everyone's an entrepreneur. And that's true, but that's only been true for the past 200 years. Prior to that, 100% of people were either entrepreneurs or serfs of some sort. And I think we're kind of out of the serf economy, and now most people want to do the things that gives them the most pleasure, whether it's writing a book or being a surgeon or whatever.
Well, I can hear someone saying, easy for James Altucher to say, he went to Cornell. I don't want to risk me or my kids not getting that same skill and pedigree. But James, you say it didn't matter. You lost millions, lost homes, companies. Sounds like lost a marriage. And
yes.
Now, is it true that you have 15 items?
Yes. So about, I guess, 5 or 6 months ago, I was doing a lot of traveling, and I realized, you know what? I only have this one bag with me. I have a lease coming up on a place I'm renting. I don't believe in owning a home.
And by the way, you don't believe in owning a home because you say people pour way too much of their money into homes now.
Yeah, nobody would ever invest all their money and then borrow another 400% to buy any investment, and yet they do it with their homes. And there's not only is there no dividend, but there's maintenance, there's taxes, there's all sorts of costs every year associated with owning a home. And exactly when you need the money out of your home is exactly when you can't get it, like during a financial crisis. Yeah. So I never own. I like the flexibility of not owning. But I decided, you know what? I'm not going to rent either. So I had a lease coming up. I asked somebody to go to my house and completely clear it out. Donate, sell, or keep everything, or throw out everything in the house. So everything from furniture, computers, my college diploma.
Well, you know, who cares about the college diploma, even if it's Cornell? But your childhood photos?
Childhood photos, everything. I never really looked at them. So if you look at something once every 5 years, it means you probably shouldn't be carrying it around. I'm just going to live a life with all the possessions that I had been carrying around. So basically a few outfits, a computer, an iPad, and a phone, you know, and I carry it around in a bag. And I live in Airbnbs, which is much more convenient for me than the hassle of renting. For instance, I took a week-long trip to California. So that meant I moved to California for a week because I took all of my possessions with me.
That's true. You also crash on friends' couches, if I understand correctly.
You know what? It's not like I'm crashing on their couches like someone who's 20 years old. I have known people for decades, and I've, as a side benefit of doing favors for people for so many years, if people are traveling or going someplace, I'll take over their apartment or house or whatever. I've stayed in some extremely nice places because I, you know, goodwill returned to you.
Is this just a matter of attitude of telling yourself, I am free, doing this makes me free, as opposed to a failure?
That's a good way to look at it, because there's always two things that constitute an event. It's the event itself and it's how you react to it. And it turns out whether you're happy or not is completely dependent on how you react to the event. So if something quote-unquote bad happens to me, I can choose still how I'm going to react to it. Oh, I don't have any belongings, but now this is great. I could stay in places all over the country. Or, all these people who have been wanting to do favors for me, just like I've done favors for them, they get a chance to do that. I'll stay in their apartment or I'll take over their house for a month or whatever.
You obviously have many fans, and a lot of this theory is written out in Choose Yourself, your book. I love there's one chapter titled How to Be Less Stupid. How do you be less stupid?
Well, I think most of the time it's, you know, everybody's like, how do I become smart? But most of the time we do things all day long that are not for the best. For instance, we might think, oh, well, I'm very busy right now, so I can't sleep 8 hours. Well, the reality is you're only going to be in your peak performance if you're sleeping, you know, 7 to 9 hours a night. You know, there are many things like that, how we eat, the type of people we spend our times with. I had one person who wrote me and said, James, I'm following this idea that you recommend of writing down ideas all day long every day. But then on Friday nights, I hang out with my friends and they all make fun of me. And I gave him one piece of advice, which is stay home on Friday night. But I never heard from him again.
That's funny recommendations. Write a list of 10 ideas every day to exercise the idea muscle before it atrophies. When you talk about sleep, go to sleep by 9, get up at 5, break a sweat at least 10 minutes a day, ditch those friends who make fun of you on Friday night.
Yeah, or put you down, or a boss who's constantly trying to make you feel bad about yourself. Try not to be around people who make you feel bad about yourself.
I mean, as someone who has lived the high life, Do you ever get that pang of, oh, but wait, I want to make sure my children go to the best schools? You know, what am I doing? I actually want to make sure that there's dance lessons or, you know, I know you're doing well. You've got best-selling books and podcasts and things.
Although I've had points in the past even few years where I've been dead broke as well. It's not how you always succeed that's important. It's how you bounce back from perceived failure that's important. And so, yes, I try to provide the best for my children. You know, within my means, I would never deny them anything.
But you don't need much right now.
I don't need or want anything.
Huh. Why do you think that the number one search phrase on Google that takes people to your blog is, I want to die?
There were definitely periods in, you know, there was one point where I made some money, I sold a company, and then I lost all the money. I made just stupid decisions. I was dead broke. I lost my home. I lost everything. And I was seriously considering, my kids were young enough, and I was thinking, you know what? It would be better. They don't know me yet. It would be better for them to have my life insurance policy than for them to have me. And so I was seriously considering it at the time. And I wrote an article about this, or a series of articles about this. One of them was titled, I Want to Die. And that became a very popular article. For a while, it was the number one search phrase on Google for the phrase, I want to die. It was the number one search result for the phrase, I want to die. And Google manually put the National Suicide Hotline above the result because so many people complained.
Hmm. We'll post the essay you wrote. The conclusion, by the way, is, when I look back on it, never did I really want my heart to stop beating. I just wanted the death of those various emotions that were hurting me. And all of them did die eventually. How small they are in the rearview mirror. Listen, we'll just stay in touch with you if we can, if we can find you.
That would be great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Ford announced today that it is working on a fleet of self-driving cars that will be on roads by 2021. As Ford CEO Mark Fields put it, there will be no steering wheel, no brake pedals, no gas pedals. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She's in New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Well, it sounds like, you know, we've heard about self-driving cars in quotes before. This is a real self-driving car. What's the plan here and is it going to happen?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, when I was getting into my car at 4:40 this morning, that sounds like a dream to me. If I could just sit
take
here.
A nap on the way to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But is it going to happen? If it were up to the car companies, maybe, especially if you're talking about realistically a trucking fleet or maybe an urban taxi fleet, as opposed to mass adoption. Might be a stretch for mass adoption, but it's not just up to the car companies, of course. It's up to the regulators, and frankly, it's also up to the driving public to get on board and to buy into this fully. And I'm not sure either of those groups are quite there yet. So from the car company perspective, they may be ready in 5 years, but I think it's going to take a little bit longer than that.
And it's only going to be available at first to these ride sharing and ride hailing services. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where the greatest need is seen, and I think it's something that they think they can control. The other thing is, you know, the other area I mentioned, trucking. They're trying to address, in the trucking instance, this problem of fatigue, of a shortage of drivers, and the monotonous. You know, they go over these long stretches, especially when you're talking cross-country. In the case of car fleets, it's going to address the other big problem, and that's congestion, pollution. And these cars kind of go the same route. If you think New York, it's a grid. A lot of cities operate on a pretty predictable pattern. I think it's a good test case. They think they could make the argument and see if this is able to play out in real life and solve some of those problems that big cities frankly struggle with.
You spoke with the CEO of Ford, Mark Fields, today. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said about why they're doing this.
We believe that the next decade is going to be defined by the automation of the vehicle, and autonomous vehicles could have the same societal impact just as much as Ford's moving assembly line did 100 years ago. And we want to lead in that regard.
They want to lead in that regard. Of course, they are up against companies like Google and Tesla, both working on these kinds of self-driving cars. How do Ford's efforts compare?
Yeah, and I spoke to him yesterday, but I think the issue is not just to lead, but to sort of stay in the race is maybe a better way to put it. It is clear the industry thinks that the future is going to contain some type of this autonomous vehicle. And interestingly, Ford is taking more of the approach of Google, where they're talking about no driver at all. A lot of the other car companies are talking about a more gradual evolution, including you know, what we've seen with Tesla, where there's still a driver there, but that the car can do more functions with you. It's important for Ford, though, right now to be making these type of investments because they haven't found a partner yet. If you think about GM, they've partnered with Lyft. Google is working with Fiat Chrysler. BMW is said to be working with Intel. So a lot of people are kind of pairing up in the dance here. Apple, by the way, won't even admit they're developing a car, but everybody thinks they are. Hmm. So Ford is kind of on their own now. They say they want to go that way. They may change their mind, but they need to be making these investments so that they can stay relevant if this does become an option.
And still some safety concerns.
A lot of safety concerns. And the biggest one, Jeremy, is can these machines mimic the sophistication of a human mind? Is the pedestrian going to step off the sidewalk? You know, will the software glitch like our computers do sometimes? It's very hard. We make a lot of decisions almost simultaneously. And can these kind of robotic cars do that? That's a big question still.
Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
While we may never see Donald Trump's personal tax returns, there is a report today about his business dealings, specifically that his Atlantic City casinos once owed almost $30 million in back taxes to the state of New Jersey. That came out in a report from the New York Times today, which also said that Trump managed to cut a settlement, paying only $5 million of those taxes, or 17 cents on the dollar. The news comes as Donald Trump's last remaining mark on Atlantic City is set to close soon. The Trump Taj Mahal, which, by the way, is no longer owned by Trump. He opened the casino back in 1990. It is owned now by fellow billionaire Carl Icahn, who plans to shut the casino's doors by October. He's citing continued financial struggles after a month-long strike led by its workers. It is the fifth casino in Atlantic City to close in the last couple of years. And we want to bring in Vincent Mazzio, who is a Democratic assemblyman representing New Jersey's second legislative district that includes Atlantic City. Assemblyman, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Great to be here.
Well, great to have you. And what did you think when you heard that this casino, yet another one, is closing in Atlantic City?
Well, certainly I'm disappointed that it did close because all the people that are affected by it, meaning the employees, but quite honest with you, we're not totally surprised. It's one of the it's one of the worst of the casinos left doing revenue wise in Atlantic City, but we certainly thought that perhaps Mr. Icahn would continue to put money into it and bring it back to its glory days when in the 90s and early 2000s where it was one of the leading casinos in Atlantic City.
Well, why do you think that he didn't want to do that? What's going wrong in Atlantic City?
Well, you know, be quite honest with you, if you look at the revenue right now in Atlantic City, it's stabilized. It's actually on a little bit of an uptick, meaning that, you know, I think we're at the bottom where we have eight casinos, including the Taj Mahal, that, you know, perhaps where the market's right now in Atlantic City. I think that, you know, quite honest with Icahn, he's a corporate guy. He's sitting on a lot of money. And, you know, he calls the shots at the end of the day. And you know, we had seven other casinos that settled all their contracts. And Taj Mahal was the last one that wasn't settled. And basically, I get it. You know, I'm a business guy. As you know, I'm a small businessman in Atlantic County. I get it. If you're not making money, you know, you can't pay it. But, you know, my estimation is that, you know, there was some room to wiggle there because he was making some small investment into the property. And, you know, if we could just settle those contracts, in my eyes, it didn't look like it was a big deal what the workers wanted. And I think that we could have moved forward and the Taj Mahal, I think, would have stayed open. And I know it'll close. It'll probably close Taj Mahal, but I don't know if it's the last days of the Taj Mahal. We'll see what happens.
Hmm. Well, what do you think happened? Because I remember right after the recession, everyone was saying places like Atlantic City are going to do well because they're so close to New York and Philadelphia that people, if they don't want to spend a lot of money flying to their vacation, at least they can go to a place like Atlantic City. So did you experience that and then it just went away? Or what do you think happened to bring down these businesses that had been there for a long time?
No, competition. I mean, certainly in other states, the competition of Delaware and Pennsylvania, there's a saturated market in gambling right now. And now that we downsized to eight casinos, the market seems to be right for Atlantic City right now. You could look at Sandy was a problem too, as far as in Atlantic City. I mean, there's some certain problems with that storm that created some hardship for Atlantic City and the economic viability of Atlantic City.
Well, the city has certainly gotten more attention in the last year because of the presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who spoke with Bloomberg News this week and was asked about his former businesses there and his name that still hangs on the Trump Taj Mahal. Let's listen.
I've got out. Some people would say good timing, but I got out many, many years ago. And I see what's happening in Atlantic City. It's just too much competition. There's too much pressure from Pennsylvania, Maryland. And ultimately, everybody's going to do badly because they're looking at casinos as a panacea. But I left Atlantic City about 8 years ago, haven't been involved. My name is on the building, and it's one of those things. But Atlantic City it's a very sad situation, just too much competition.
Now, you are a Democrat, but if I can ask you to take the politics out of it for a moment, do you think that Trump could have done something differently that would have helped Atlantic City? Did he have the potential to change the narrative at all?
Well, I think when he first started in Atlantic City, I think there was a lot of good positive. You know, he put some investment dollars into Atlantic City, and he had, I believe, one time four casinos. So from that perspective, being a legislator or a politician or in the political environment, that's what we want to see happen to Atlantic City and Atlantic County is to have investments. And Donald Trump did do that. But what he didn't do, he didn't pay a lot of small businesses in Atlantic County. And, you know, there's hardship there. And this sounds funny, but, you know, I'm a small business person. We do gift baskets. He still owes me $98 from 1996 for gift baskets for Trump Plaza Casino. I mean, you know, he single-handedly, when he does bankruptcies, he hurt so many businesses in our area that they didn't get paid, but a lot of them went out of business. Some hung on because they had the capital to do so. But I think that the small thing that he could have done was pay the businesses in town. He did do some good things as far as investing, but he didn't follow through and help the smaller guy or the middle class people who, you know, are small business people and need that money that they did their work, and at the end of the day they should have got paid in full. But he was paying people 10 cents on the dollar.
Is there resentment of him in Atlantic City?
Oh, definitely. There's in Atlantic City, Atlantic County, a lot of local people just, you know, they hear the name Donald Trump, they just cringe. They don't like, you know, what he did to the area or what some of the things with bankruptcy. Donald Trump certainly doesn't have a name that is respect in Atlantic City or Atlantic County right now. That's for sure.
That's Vincent Mazzio, a Democratic assemblyman representing New Jersey's second legislative district, which includes Atlantic City. Assemblyman Mazzio, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we want to take a few minutes now to note the passing of John McLaughlin, who for more than three decades hosted the McLaughlin Group, a political roundtable TV show.
From Washington, the McLaughlin Group, the American original.
McLaughlin, a former Jesuit priest from Providence, Rhode Island, started the show each week with an issue up for debate.
Issue one. Hacking the election. Issue 1. Orlando and politics. Issue 1. Taliban terror. Issue 1. Policies on poverty.
He had four guests, including regulars Eleanor Clift, Pat Buchanan, Clarence Page, Mort Zuckerman. He often tangled with them, like in this exchange with Tony Blankley back in 2003.
Does the lady in question fall under the act in question?
It looks like she does. The question is,
what about the 5-year rule?
She's been outside 5 years. We don't know the move. This is less important than.
Well, isn't that the distinction between a felony and a non-felony?
This is whoever leaked it has to worry about that. The rest of us.
Does Novak have to worry about it?
No, Novak's not covered because there are only two categories of people covered: one, authorized possessors of the information.
Well, why do you support Novak's judgment in this and revealing the name?
I don't.
And that combative style got the attention of Saturday Night Live and Dana Carvey.
Now that Bush has scraped Buchanan off his shoe, will his platform be affected even one iota by the views of Pat Buchanan? Pat Buchanan!
Well, John, I think I made significant inroads into the Republican...
Wrong, Freddie! Wrong, come on!
On The Real Show, McLaughlin always ended with predictions from his guests, followed by one from him.
Gorbachev will visit Tokyo within 1 year and offer them sovereignty of the Sakhalin Islands, thus opening the Moscow-Tokyo axis, Kuril Islands. Thank you, Patrick. Next week, Gorby visits the Gipper. Happy birthday, First Lady Barbara Bush. Bye-bye.
The McLaughlin Group was about making politics interesting, even humorous when few were doing so. It was a political debate show before there were 24-hour channels devoted to political debate shows. And in the 34 years McLaughlin did his show, he only missed one show, the one 2 days before he died at the age of 89.
Last night, Simone Biles took home her fourth gold medal for women's floor exercise. Very exciting. But tonight, Croatia and Poland face off in the men's team handball quarterfinals. What? You haven't been following handball? Perhaps it's because it doesn't look like handball. And the U.S. isn't competing and hasn't since the 1996 Olympics. But American players are hoping to change that. Andres Espinoza is a member of the Los Angeles Team Handball Club. He plays for the USA Beach Handball Team. And Andres, I'm sure a lot of people say to you all the time, handball, it's that's the thing that people did in Brooklyn, slapping the ball against the stoop or a wall.
You know, initially people always think it's the one against the wall, but it's on a big court, it's 7-on-7, and you basically throw the ball in the goal. A lot of people describe it as water polo on land.
That's water polo on land, that's perfect. Yeah. So it's a ball, it weighs about a pound, bigger than a baseball, but not as big as a basketball, so you can palm it. And people throw it, what, forward to each other instead of dribbling?
Yeah, there's dribbling involved and a lot of passing. And, yeah, basically there's a goalie, and you try to throw it past him and score on the goal. You can get up to, 60, 70 miles an hour from some of the top players.
And how'd you find out about it?
Well, back in 2008, I was watching TV late night, and I when the Olympics were on, and I saw a sport I've never seen before. I think it was, the Brazilian women team, and I was like, what is this? They're running around the court fast, firing the ball, but a lot of passing. There's dribbling. And I just looked into it and found an L.A. team and been playing it for about 8 years now.
Well, and what a disappointment then that you've gotten into a sport that could be your ticket to the Olympics, except what? The U.S. hasn't qualified.
Yeah. Like you said, 96 was the last time USA was in the Olympics, and that was from an automatic bid from hosting. It's a small sport compared to the rest of the world. It's professional in Europe, in South America, and... it's a tough game to get into, but we've had a good time trying, but they have not qualified in, 20 years.
Well, the men's team ranked 38th in the International Handball Federation, which makes no sense to a lot of observers, and maybe you too. I mean, this seems as if it would be a sport made for Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on a court. It's about 40 feet longer than an NBA basketball court, 15 feet wider. It's real fast. It's real physical. You would think a lot of Americans would love this sport, and they would if it got some exposure, but, most people don't know about it.
Yeah, well, just the fact that you say it's like water polo, people don't have respect for water polo that, in fact, I think they should. I mean, I can't imagine, breathing, swimming, and trying to, get a ball down a water court. I mean, it's incredibly hard, but is that a part of it that there's just, unless you know how hard it is, there's just less respect for it?
Yeah, well, you grow up in the U.S., the main sports are, of course, basketball, football, baseball. You grow up playing in high school. And, handball is, like I said, professional in Europe. And so a lot of kids, when they're young, they start playing that. And it's hard to really compete with people that have been playing their whole lives when, a lot of the players here, maybe after their college careers or even some pro athletes that pick it up in their 20s, and it's, they're really far behind someone that's playing their whole life.
How big are the big names in the game in Europe?
In some countries, it's the second most popular sport. And the top players, like Nikola Karabatic, Mikael Hansen, they make $12, $13 million a year.
Wow.
They get thousands of spectators at their game. So it's big, and it's a lot bigger than we know of here.
Well, and some of them, we understand from this Washington Post article, are asking, what would happen if LeBron James, decided to take up handball? I mean, do you think, as some are speculating, and no offense to you, who's, taken up this sport, but would we just squash other countries if we had those players? Or is it not that easy to transfer skills?
Yeah, you know, it's real interesting to think of. I mean, I've thought about that for years, but when they say that in the articles and, you know, people every 4 years, they see this sport and they think, oh, like, just put our top athletes in it and we'll just be the best. It's really undervaluing how good a lot of the athletes are that play this professionally. And I think his skill set, in particular LeBron James or like a Russell Westbrook, it would be amazing to see. But it's not all about athleticism. You know, it's a really technical sport.
Do you understand there's more contact?
Oh, yeah. It's a real physical sport. I would say it's somewhere in between basketball and rugby. You hit people hard and you wrap them up. Those are normal fouls, and it's a good way to play defense. So it gets real physical out there.
Well, what should people do if they're saying, you know what, let's do this. Let's get out there. Let's get this Americans back in this sport in the Olympics. What should they do?
I would just encourage anyone who wants to try the sport out, who has a past in athletics, you know, college, pro, or, you know, any level, to come out and try it. Like I said, it's fast, it's physical, and we encourage anyone to come try it.
Well, we understand that the USA Handball headquarters in Auburn, Alabama, is holding a tryout because some former college athletes have, you know, shown an interest. Like, well, maybe I could get into the Olympics if I can learn this sport. So there's a tryout on October 15th. We'll let people know more about it. Andres Espinoza of the Los Angeles Team Handball Club, who also plays for the USA Beach Handball Team. That's like, what, beach volleyball mixed with water polo mixed with rugby?
Yeah, it's like beach volleyball versus indoor volleyball. It's the same, but it's a lot different.
Yeah. Andres, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Jeremy, we're signing up. October 15th, that's us. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.